Okay, you've been listening to a conversation with, of course, the vice chair of the U.S. Federal Reserve, Lael Brainard, in conversation with Bloomberg's Peggy Collins. A really interesting conversation, a lot to take away from it. The main headline that you should probably focus on, though, to begin with, is that Brainard was talking about the fact that we are now probably at the point where it is appropriate to soon move to a slower rate of hikes. I think the market had largely got to that point. Mm-hmm. I think while Jay Powell at his last press conference was more hawkish than anticipated, I think he was clear in the fact that we are getting to that point, and certainly the dot plots have put us in a place where we are migrating from a 75 basis point hike to a 50 basis point hike. So that's where we are right now in terms of the market reaction. Let me walk you through what is going on. You've got a US 2-year that is trading at 4.406. So that wraps up that kind of part of the Bloomberg coverage of Lael Brainard's speech and conversation at Bloomberg. But Alex, we are now listening to the cable. We need to talk about what is happening more broadly. So I'm Guy Johnson. This evening I'm in Berlin. Alex Steele is still resolutely in New York. Alex, your takeaway from what we got there, what do you think? What was the main takeaway from Brainard?
I actually feel like the dove wasn't actually so dovish. Like, that they also really stood behind the "we're not there yet." So that very much echoed what Chris Waller had said, is that we're not there yet when it comes to inflation. So maybe slowing the pace of hikes doesn't mean that we're slowing the destination or changing the destination. And the market really reacted, I mean, in kind. Like, you definitely saw a sell-off all across the curve in the bond market, you know, 9, 8, 10 basis points higher on the two-year. Very different than what we're seeing, say, over in Europe.
Absolutely. Yields have come down. I would say yields have come down just a smidge at the front end over the last, say, 10 or 15 minutes. Ira Jersey is probably the person to ask about all of this. He's Bloomberg Intelligence's chief U.S. rate strategist. Ira, your takeaway from what we just heard from Lael Brainard?
Yeah, not much new from the vice chair, but I think it's important that some of the things that she mentioned about the future of rate hikes and the reiteration of it is important. And I think the bond market responded a little bit during her speech, where the long end of the yield curve actually rallied a little bit, and you're seeing a bit of a flatter curve since her remarks started.
So does that mean that my interpretation that she didn't sound as dovish as we might have assumed is incorrect?
Well, no, not so much that she wasn't as dovish. I don't think she was dovish at all, and I don't think, you know, I think we're talking about, you know, nuances of how hawkish they are versus, you know, are they going to cut? You know, the fact that she didn't say commit to anything, saying that there's the likelihood, like that question toward the end of the remarks of the questions about whether or not they could cut in 2023. You know, she basically said we're data dependent, right? We're all about the data. We don't know if we're going to hike more. We don't know if we're going to cut more. That's effectively what she said. And I think the important message came at the very beginning when she did reiterate, hey, we're going to probably slow down because we've done a lot of hiking already and we have tightened financial conditions, but we don't know how high we're going to go. And I think that this is something that I think I've talked about with both of you over the last month or 6 weeks, is about the idea that they have to downshift a little bit because now they can calibrate how high they get the Fed funds rate. Because if they need to go more, say in March or May or June of next year, they could just go further in smaller increments as opposed to, you know, hiking at 50 or 75 basis point clips.
Can we just talk about calibration for a moment? Does a 50 basis point hike have a bigger, smaller, greater, lesser effect at this stage in the hiking cycle than say at the beginning? I'm just wondering how you think about, as you go through a very steep hiking cycle, how the change in increments has a different effect at different points in that evolution. How do we think about that?
Well, I think initially, you know, the idea, and this was Jim Bullard's kind of, you know, getting in front of this back in April, talking about, you know, that we have to basically tighten and financial conditions very quickly and fast. So the initial 50 basis point hike back in May, you know, it didn't take anyone by surprise. We all thought they were going to do it. you know, that was important, right? Because you were saying, like, hey, we are going to tighten financial conditions. We're going to tighten faster than we did, say, in the 2004-2005 hiking cycle when it was 25 basis points every meeting for 2.5 years. Now we're saying, hey, we might go faster than that. And that had a profound effect, certainly on the rates market, right? That's when you saw a very significant sell-off. You saw a very aggressive flattening of the yield curve. And two-year notes sold off the most that they have since the early 1980s. So I think now the slowing is going to have less of an effect on the Treasury market, but it'll still have a significant it'll be meaningful if the market continues to mm-hmm. think that the Fed's going to hike at smaller increments, because you'll wind up probably with, as they go higher, if they go higher than 5%, certainly, and the market expects that, you'll get even a flatter yield curve and expectations for a deeper slowdown later, say in 2024. And that's the dynamic that we're kind of waiting for and watching. And this is the tightrope that mm-hmm. the Fed's currently walking.
Right, like the tip when we go from inflation to the growth scares. Hey, I just want to also talk about the inflation expectations data from the New York Fed that came out. This is for October. It came out at the top of the 11 o'clock hour, and 3 years ahead was looking at 3.1%, 1 year inflation expectations looking at 5.9%. That's when we really saw a bigger move in the front end, and I'm wondering what your takeaway was from these numbers.
Yeah, it's hard to know because they are a little bit lagged and a little bit behind. We already have the CPI data from October, I guess the question is, like, when you have measures like this, you know, are they lagging what already occurred? And I think that a lot of the survey measures, whether it's Michigan or the New York, forward ahead survey, is all going to be a little bit lagged. But that being said, if you look at 2 year inflation swaps, they're still at 2.8%. So the market is still thinking that we're going to have inflation that's well above the Fed's comfort zone, at least for the next couple of years. So I think that's kind of another indicator that's suggesting that the persistence of inflation will be a little bit more than the Federal Reserve might want. And my view on that from the Fed's perspective is that means that the Fed is just going to stay on hold at whatever the peak is for longer than the market's currently anticipating.
Ira, if relations improve with China or don't deteriorate further from here, and we've seen a meeting today between Presidents Biden and Xi that sounded a little bit more optimistic than maybe people had anticipated, Does that have a direct line or a dotted line into inflation expectations, do you think?
Yeah, maybe a little bit. You know, the inflation expectations part of it, I think, Guy, is a little bit trickier than actual inflation, because if there is an easing of tensions between the U.S. and China on a trade front, then that could potentially mean that you have even lower goods prices. Goods prices are already coming down in many sectors, and I think that's being missed because services prices keep on climbing quite dramatically. But if those fall even further, then certainly that's good for inflation, probably good for inflation expectations. But on the other side, it's almost exactly parallel the other way. If things deteriorate, then the question is, will inflation go up because we have to find new sources for some of the goods or intermediate components that come out of China for a lot of the manufactured goods and the like? So I think it is reasonably symmetric, and it'll be interesting to hear what President Biden says is coming out of that meeting with the Chinese premier today.
Before we let you go, Ira, we will talk about that in a moment as well. But before we let you go, what is the pain trade in the bond market towards the end of the year right now?
Yeah, I think it would be a pretty big rally. I think a lot of people are still generally short. There are a lot of people still in yield curve flatteners, which obviously are working today. But you've seen bouts when people have gotten out of those, and you've seen some bare steepening of the yield curve. And I think that that's an indication that people are generally short, generally in flatteners still. So a further rally would be a real pain point, I think, for a lot of investors.
Ira, really appreciate it. Thank you so very much. Ira Jersey, Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Strategist for rates. And you're looking at, let me just pull up the two-year here to tell you what is going on. You are looking at a two-year yield is up by about 8 basis points at this point. It was 10 a little bit earlier, but 4.41 on the 2-year. The back end, the 10-year yields are up by about 5.6, about 6 basis points there. All right, coming up, we have much to discuss. There is an autumn statement happening finally on Thursday. We're going to get a preview of that. There's lots of drip feed about what to expect. We will talk about that in just a moment. Also, Guy had his Super Bowl basically in Berlin. He talked to the CEO of Airbus. We're going to get more on that. It's not only an industrial story and a travel story, it's also a China and the West story as well. We'll break all of that down over the next hour. You're listening to The Cable. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in Berlin, Alex Steele in New York. We are counting you down towards the fiscal statement, which we're going to get later on this week. Today we heard from Michael Saunders, formerly, of course, of Citigroup. He was the chief European economist there. And then following that, he joined the Bank of England as an independent member of the Monetary Committee. The theory that he was talking about today was that basically the UK economy has been, quote, permanently damaged by Brexit, and we wouldn't be having an austerity budget this week if we hadn't had Brexit. But we are, it looks like, going to have an austerity budget. We are going to see significant tax rises. We are going to see significant cuts. All of this coming at a time where we are moving into a recession. Bloomberg's Jamie Rush joins us now to discuss this. Jamie, let's start off first of all with the comments from Saunders. Michael Saunders talking about the fact that that Brexit has been permanently damaged the UK economy. Is he right?
Yeah, I think it's pretty unequivocal that that's the case. When you look at what's happened to trade, we are significantly undershooting our peers. When you look at business investment relative to the rest of the G7, it's significantly lower. And these are things which boost productivity, raise income sustainably, and therefore the fact that we're not doing so well at these things means that the economy is smaller.
Smaller and no easy fix at the end of the day. Saunders also talked about some alternatives to a headline tax rate. Like, we all know spending is going to slow and taxes are going to go up. He's talking about introducing a tiered system of interest rates on bank reserves and reducing tax relief for top rate taxpayers on pension contributions. So just like a little bit of finessing here and there that would do less damage to the economy. What do you think about these kind of suggestions? Is that going to move the needle here?
So I think the reserves in the system and basically excluding some of those from interest rates, to me, that is a tax on savers. So banks will have to compete away the change of this impact on interest rates, which means that you're basically just going to reduce the rate of interest that's passed on to people who are saving. So we talk about it, as it's often talked about as if it's a tax on the banking sector. Actually, I think the burden of it will be felt by ordinary people who have savings. So it's not clear to me that, it feels to me a lot like that's just a fiscal policy. And if they want to do it, then maybe it's better to do it with a fiscal measure rather than tinkering with the system. Pension, you could raise a bit of money through that. It's not huge. I think there are other measures on the table which would do a lot more.
Okay, so let's talk about the aggregates of all the leaks that we've now had. What is your expectation in terms of how much fiscal tightening there's going to be, how much tax raising there is going to be, and when that is all going to happen? At what point will the peak of that policy impact the UK economy?
Okay, so let's just cut down the numbers. So March this year, there was £30 billion of headroom. It looks like the OBR is going to say there's £30 billion of bad news, so that wipes out the headroom. And that's just on interest rates, and then £40 billion of extra bad news because the economy is going to be smaller, which means you have this £40 billion hole, and the Chancellor is going to fill it with £55-ish billion worth of austerity. So that's going to leave you back in roughly where you started, but only with about £10 billion of headroom against the target the government sets itself. So that's what we're expecting, £50 billion-ish, and we think a lot of it is going to be backloaded. So beyond the point, after the next election, which is in 2024. So in all likelihood, it's going to end up being Labour's problem, potentially not the Conservatives.
I have a really dumb question. Why do we need to get to zero on that? Like, I understand that it's going to be backloaded, et cetera, but why not a small budget deficit? Like, why do we need to do all this to get to zero?
Yeah, it's not a dumb question at all. I mean, they've set themselves these targets, which are very rigid. So they say they want to get debt falling by the third year, the forecast, probably the fifth year now. And to do that, there is a number you need to target. And so every time the forecast changes, they had to do some policy to get to the number. Pretty much nobody else in the world sets policy this way. It's very reactionary. It causes a lot of fiscal changes, policy changes, and uncertainty. And the UK shouldn't be doing it. But this is where we are, and this is how policy is currently being set.
What impact did the mini budget have on this in terms of credibility? Would that not have happened? How much more wiggle room would the Chancellor have at this point?
I don't think it's really an issue now. So I think at the height of the crisis in September, October, it was a serious problem. Borrowing costs are much higher than our peers. Now, borrowing costs are very close to what we have, what we see elsewhere in Europe. So it's not. I don't think it has had a huge lasting impact.
Would the market let the government run a bigger deficit? Would the market be...
Yeah.
Are we over-tightening to please the markets when actually the markets are as you say, have already moved beyond worrying about it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think a lot of this and what we've learned over the past few months is that personalities really matter. The people in charge are making decisions which are in the right direction, and I think they probably are going to go over the top on austerity without all that much justification for it, really. There is a case for just focusing on the problems we have now, getting the other side, and then seeing how much we need to do after that.
Does this change the conversation in the BOE? Medium term. Short term, maybe not. Medium term.
No, I think it will, because it depends crucially on how much of the consolidation is backloaded beyond the Bank of England's forecast horizon. If it happens in 3 years' time, they don't care. So it potentially could have a big bearing on the rates path over the next 2 years.
All right, Jamie, we really appreciate it. Thank you so very much for joining us. Jamie Rush, European Economics Chief, European Economist. I don't envy what you're going to get on Thursday. I guess the upside here, Guy, is that maybe we know what's actually going to happen versus because we've had such a drip feed. I mean, maybe there's going to be no surprises, and you can probably imagine the market's going to enjoy a lack of surprise.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced about that.
I'm looking for a silver lining, man.
I think the news is going to be grim, and I think to Jamie's point, there is a danger that the Chancellor over-tightens into what could be a very difficult recession.
Yep. 100%, and then the hurdle for actually providing fiscal support is super, super high at that point. All right, much more coming up. We're going to turn our focus to President Xi and Biden's meeting earlier today. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson over in Berlin for a change. He was interviewing the Airbus CEO. We will hear from that interview later on in the hour. Let's get a quick market check here. Stocks pretty much going a whole lot of nowhere. You had Chris Waller tempering expectations over the weekend, saying that we are far from our goal on inflation. Lyle Brainer, vice chair, just speaking with Bloomberg in the last hour, saying something relatively similar, that we're soon to be at the point where we can slow the pace of rate hikes, but we still have a lot of work to do. Breaking apart what we're seeing here, you're looking at most sectors in the red, with the exception of materials, healthcare, and consumer staples. Energy also trying to eke out a gain as well. You have Hasbro, the worst performing stock on the S&P. It did get a downgrade, and that's really weighing on the equity there. And, you know, yields are up, dollar up. I feel like we're a little bit of status quo here. Now we're just looking for the next catalyst to focus in on. That's a quick snapshot of U.S. equities. Now let's bring in Charlie Pellett for some more headlines.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. London has lost another status symbol. It is no longer home to Europe's biggest stock market. That prize has been taken by France and its stable of luxury companies like LVMH and Gucci Owner Kering, which are riding a wave of optimism that Chinese shoppers will be eager to spend as COVID restrictions Britain's ease. It is another symbolic sign of Britain's shrinking place in the wake of Brexit and the continental rivals that will step into that position. Former Bank of England policymaker Michael Saunders says Britain's exit from the European Union is one of the reasons why the UK is now entering a period of austerity. In an interview with Bloomberg Television, Saunders said the UK economy as a whole has been permanently damaged by Brexit. UK home sellers slashed their asking prices at the quickest pace since August last month after a surge in mortgage costs and looming recession put a chill on the property market. The property search website Rightmove said asking prices fell 1.1% this month after a 0.9% gain in October, but the cuts are the norm in the autumn when sellers went up to want to wrap up transactions before Christmas. Meanwhile, Michael Gove has accused Britain's biggest house builders of making unattractive and poor quality homes, and he's pledged government intervention to improve the state of the country's new housing stock. Gove, who previously clashed with house building companies over the UK's cladding scandal, was reappointed Secretary of State for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities last month after Rishi Sunak took over as Prime Minister. Gove was fired from the same position in July by then Prime Minister Boris Johnson. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie, thank you so much. The other big news of the day was the meetup between Joe Biden and Xi Jinping. Both presidents sat face-to-face for 3 hours in Bali on the outskirts of the G20. It seemed to be a big thaw in some of the relations between the two. They said they're going to resume cooperation on issues like climate change and food security. And they jointly went against the Kremlin a bit for the Kremlin's loose talk of nuclear war over Ukraine. President Biden then gave about a half-hour press conference afterwards. Here's part of what he had to say on Taiwan.
I absolutely believe there need not be a new Cold War. I do not think there's any imminent attempt on the part of China to invade Taiwan. And I made it clear that our policy on Taiwan has not changed at all.
Pretty clear words, Guy, for a president who sometimes says something a little bit different.
Absolutely. And maybe there's no need at this point for his staff to kind of walk back, talk back some of his comments, which we've seen recently. I thought it was fascinating that this was a much more productive conversation that a lot of people had anticipated. Maybe we still are at the point where we need to stop things getting worse before we start talking about things getting better. But even so, it sounded much less belligerent than some had led us to believe that this conversation would be, that it was all going to be about red lines and was going to be about sort of staking out where everybody stood. It did sound much more positive, and there were handshakes. It looked, the body language looked good as well. Alex, you and I caught up with Robert Hormats, former Under Secretary of State for Economic Growth at the State Department. He is a longtime China watcher. And I think we were all a bit surprised at how well this meeting had gone. And I asked him, I think we kicked the conversation off by asking about whether or not this was detente. This was a real thawing in relations.
I wouldn't use the word detente quite yet, but it is certainly an improvement compared to where we were prior to the meeting. And the fact that there is going to be, as you mentioned, a series of follow-up engagements between Tony Blinken and his counterpart and other cabinet members with their Chinese counterparts is encouraging, because our two sides have really not been talking at very high levels for quite some time. And partly due to COVID, partly due to the overall tenor of the relationship. But this actually improves engagement, and I think that's a very positive development.
You've known, Bob, hi, it's great to see you.
Good to be here.
You've known Xi for a long time. Do we take what happened at face value? Do we trust this interaction?
I think we, as President Reagan said, trust but verify. But I would say this about President Xi. I've known him since he was party secretary in Zhejiang province. He's a very candid guy, and he prides himself on being candid. He doesn't hold back. And I think that he probably told President Biden what was on his mind, certainly made a big point on Taiwan of this being a red line, numerous other issues. I'm sure he was quite blunt, and I think President Biden was as well. And that's actually very healthy. When I first went to China in the early 70s, Mao was then the party chairman and the leader of China. And he made an interesting point. He said, look, if we say everything is good and happy talk, no one will believe us. We have to demonstrate that we're talking candidly to each other, even if we disagree, but all so that the things we do agree on will have more credibility.
That was Bob Hormats, former Undersecretary of State for Economic Growth. All right, let's go to Bali right now and speak to Anne-Marie Hordern, who has been traveling with the president, and she joins us now. Anne-Marie, what surprised me about what Bob said is that he kind of believes what we saw. And that was my question to you. Like, everything looked nice, but behind the closed doors, was it actually nice? Was there a slow drip towards a detente?
Well, I think actions will speak louder than words. And what you saw here is that there was a very low bar going into this meeting, right? No deliverables, no joint communique. They each put out their separate readouts. It was really what the United States said wanted to set a floor in the relationship. And what came out of it was the fact that you're going to see senior officials resume discussions on a number of issues like climate, like food security, like health, like debt sustainability, which is a huge issue in this part of the world, as well as in Africa, and as well as the fact that the president's top diplomat, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, will be making a trip to China out of this meeting to continue on these discussions. So when you see that, you can tell this is a warming of relationships, and potentially they see as at least some sort of path forward when it comes to at least engaging again when it comes to communications. Remember, comms really broke down after Speaker Pelosi visited Taiwan this summer.
Anne-Marie, let's talk about kind of that journey forward. Is it a journey forward, or is it basically we are in a position where we're not trying to make things worse anymore? The relationship had been deteriorating. The Nancy Pelosi trip obviously was a real low point. But are we now stabilizing a relationship that was in danger of getting significantly worse and dangerously worse?
It does feel that way in the sense that the president was in Cambodia and he met with his allies, notably the leaders of Japan and South Korea, as well as Australia, but really Japan and South Korea, because also for them, they have U.S. military bases on their land. And when there is potentially this threat or looming idea of a war in the Taiwan Strait, it's these countries that are incredibly concerned and that would potentially be on the fringes of that war. And something else they wanted the president to bring up to Xi Jinping was to really try to rein in North Korea. And if he doesn't, the president was said to make clear before going to that meeting, according to Jake Sullivan, that the U.S. would put a bigger military presence in the Asia Pacific. So the president described it as a candid conversation. It does seem like that's what it was in terms of all issues. And I think for American allies around the world, this is actually what they wanted to see.
Anne-Marie, great stuff. Thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Anne-Marie Hordern joining us from Bali and the G20 meeting. Joining me now here in the studio in Berlin is Bloomberg's Benedikt Kamel. Benedikt, I want to talk about where this leaves Germany in particular. Olaf Scholz, the German Chancellor, recently made a trip to China. It was controversial on a number of fronts, particularly when viewed through the lens of what is happening in Ukraine right now. There's this view that Germany made a big mistake when it came to its relationships with Russia. It used cheap Russian energy to build its economy, and now it's making a similar mistake when it comes to China. Did today and the more positive tone that came out of the meeting between Biden and Xi in some ways exonerate, maybe that's too strong a word, but make life easier for the Chancellor?
That's certainly one of the issues that was hanging over that trip that you mentioned to China, that there was concern that Germany would repeat the mistakes that they made in Russia, now basically going somewhere else but making the same mistake, i.e. China. And Scholz was under considerable pressure to show that's not the only place he's going. He went around the region as well. He was trying to make sure that he wasn't putting all his diplomatic or corporate eggs into one basket. Interestingly, we spoke with the Airbus CEO today, and he used something quite similar. He said, we're not naive. and with regard to China. And he said, we want to make sure, yes, this is an important market, it's a market that we've built up over decades, but we have to look at the geopolitical risk that exists, and we have to make sure that we're not naive and that we're not going to repeat the same mistakes that we made in Russia, and that we were suddenly, almost overnight, found that that market had disappeared, it had vanished, and all the problems that we see now.
Well, that was like a perfect almost tease to our next segment, which will be the Airbus CEO with Guy. But before we get there, does Mr. Olaf's trip now, after Biden and Xi sort of thawed relations a bit, look a lot better than it did optically a couple weeks ago?
It certainly does, and particularly for a chancellor who some people have said has been too timid on the global stage, that people say he's struggled to really find his voice. He obviously had big shoes to fill after Angela Merkel, who was such a sort of reliable presence, and there was the issue that he'd been too timid vis-a-vis Russia. China is obviously a very important market for Germany, make no mistake about it. And Germany doesn't really have a choice other than embrace operations and business with China. Some of the biggest companies in Germany, from BMW to Siemens to Airbus, have a major presence over there. So you can't ignore that market. But I think that there's a lot of lessons to be learned from what went wrong with Russia, where we, you know, to use Fourier's quote, naively sort of walked into that relationship and didn't think about a plan B and what might happen if things went south, that they don't want to repeat that same mistake.
One of the reasons why Guillaume Faury was here was to meet German aerospace executives. And it comes at an interesting time because France and Germany don't necessarily feel like they're always on the same page. In fact, increasingly they feel like they are on different pages a lot of the time. And that is represented in aerospace, but it's represented in a lot of other areas as well. If Europe wants to exert its voice in this conversation between China and the United States, presumably it needs to have one voice. And it's not necessarily Germany's.
That's right, and that's the big complication right now. The two big continental powers, Germany and France, aren't speaking with one voice, as you say. You know, Macron and Scholz have a difficult relationship. It was interesting to hear from the French ambassador to Germany today at the meeting that he said, we really want to cooperate. We need to get this on even keel again. There's a lot of concern that no country can go its own way. No country can sort of unilaterally just dictate which way it wants to go. They need to work together. The UK is a bit of an outsider at this point. Italy has a new government. So really, it has to be Germany and France that cooperate. And for decades, really, those two countries did pull together. And there's a lot of concern that that's no longer the case.
Just 30 seconds here, Benny. Is it up to companies now to toe the right kind of line?
I mean, companies can't do this single-handedly. They always need the backing of the government, and we've seen that's not always easy. So they really need the reassurance from the government, which is why, you know, to come back to your question earlier, Scholz's trip was very important, and to reassure them that, yes, we want you to do business here in China, and we've got your back.
All right, Benny, thanks a lot. Benedict Campbell joining us from the Bureau. Coming up, this was a perfect segue. It's like we planned it. Talking about Airbus CEO Guillaume Faury. I spoke to Guy earlier. We're going to break down all of that conversation. I get to interview Guy. This is kind of like a Super Bowl. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio, 48 minutes past the hour. I'm Guy Johnson in Berlin alongside Alex Steele in New York. As we've been discussing, I'm here in Berlin today for a conversation that I had a little bit earlier on with the Airbus CEO, Guillaume Faury. We talked about all kinds of things. We certainly spent a bit of our conversation talking about what was happening with China. We started off our conversation talking about the fact that France and Germany don't necessarily feel like they're on the same page at the moment. This was his comment on that thought.
In Europe, we are faced with many challenges, be it on the energy side, on defense and others who have large dimensions. And obviously, France and Germany come from different places and they have different priorities and the stakes are not the same. So we are at a moment where it's not easy to find way forward together, but it's never been so important to find those solutions together. So that's one of the reasons we're here. We have a lot of cooperation in Europe that involve German projects, Germany, the German industry, and the French side as well. Most of them are very successful. New ones are being prepared, or have been recently engaged, yeah. And we want to make this successful. The way to have Germany and France cooperating is having common projects, is having common programs, is having joint stakes together, and that's what we are in charge of. So this visit here in Berlin today is in that frame, is against that backdrop of a lot of challenges in Europe, but at the defining moment, we're finding solutions together in Europe is probably more important than ever.
What about on the subject of China? John was just bringing us the headlines from the meeting between President Biden and President Xi. I'm not going to ask you to comment on those. But we have just also had a trip by the German Chancellor Olaf Scholz to Germany, to China, taking a number of German industrial leaders with him. He's trying to be constructive when it comes to China. Many in Europe, again, are questioning that. Where do you stand? Airbus got some big orders out of that trip. Where does Airbus stand on this relationship with China?
We're working very closely with China on different fronts when it comes to commercial aviation and civil helicopters. We're not involved in defense, obviously, but on the civil aviation side, we have a long-lasting and very successful cooperation. We are buying from China. We are manufacturing in China. We have a final assembly line for the very successful A320 family in Tianjin, and we are also serving the market. We have in China a market share that is roughly 20%, and we want to keep, 50%.
So
50%, the Chinese market is 20% of the world,
yeah.
And we have a market share of 50% in China. We want to keep this position, this commercial position, but we're not naive. We see the way the world is evolving and the challenges of making business between China, the West, Europe, and the US. The way we're looking at it, is the following. It took 50 years to build the high level of interdependency that we have today between the Chinese and the Western economies. This will not be changed overnight. And I'm not even sure we would want to change that very deep cooperation we have on the industrial side. But we need to make sure we are less exposed to risk of a geopolitical nature, because we see the way the tensions are rising. So that's the way we're trying to navigate, but we do it trying to speak openly with our Chinese partners, with our Chinese customers, which are still in a very different situation on the COVID side, still very much impacted by COVID, and looking forward into a future where Airbus, for civil aviation and helicopters, will continue to play a big role serving the Chinese industry.
Let's try and make a bit of news here. You have a 700 delivery target by year end. You are going to have to go some to make that target. You've climbed mountains in November and December before. Mm-hmm. Are you going to do it this time? Is the risk that this year you're not going to make that number? How are you seeing things at the moment? How confident are you that you can make that 700? Mm-hmm.
Well, we've maintained the guidance of 700 a couple of weeks ago when we announced our third quarter results, because we think we can get there. It's indeed an interesting challenge. We are working against the backdrop of a very difficult environment, industrial environment. The supply chains are really challenged by all the disruptions we see around us. But yes, we are working against that goal. And I hope we want to be able to do the same as what we did in 18 and 19 before COVID, having a lot of deliveries in the last 2 months of the year. Obviously, having the hope that we will reach this 700 marks. The guidance is around 700. That's what we're targeting.
Guillaume Faury, the Airbus CEO, talking to me here in Berlin a little earlier on, Alex. He says he's not naive about China. That's the line that really stands out about that relationship. They are clearly aware of the risks. China has a huge place in Airbus's future on current trajectories, but that could be whipped away in a moment. We've seen that happen in Russia. You've seen stranded assets. Companies have basically had to write those assets off, and Airbus is really exposed on that side.
Well, that's what I was trying to understand, that like if we want to really pay attention to where the balance of power is shifting, do we need to look at how companies are managing the relationship rather than politicians? Because it seems like that word of caution and not being naive was also quite prescient. What was the question you didn't get to ask him? I always love this one. There's always like a million that you wish you would have asked. Was there one that you felt
so
like got away?
Fortunately, I then got another half an hour with him.
Okay.
After that conversation. So we talked about all kinds of things. What we talked about in that half an hour, though, was a lot about supply chains and what is happening with supply chains right now. they've had to do an awful lot of work to make sure that their supply chain is secure. Like building an airplane, you are, it's thousands and thousands and thousands of little bits, and if one of those is missing, you're toast. So they've had to do a lot of that. And one of the things I learned from that was that as we've seen COVID aid being withdrawn from companies, those smaller businesses have had to go back to the banks, and Airbus and the bigger companies have basically had to go to the banks with them and hold their hand and say, look, these guys have got really big order books. We really need these companies in order for the banks to lend them money. And that's the role they're having to play right now within the supply chain.
That's actually quite interesting. Anyway, it was a great interview. Thank you for bringing it and sharing it throughout the day. Okay, that pretty much wraps it up for me and Guy. We get a lot coming out tomorrow in the U.S. in particular, PPI and final demand. So all of that quite interesting. We're also continuing to look at the unraveling of Sam Bankman-Fried's crypto empire and where the next shoe will be dropping to that extent. Guy will be also back in London, so looking forward to that travel safely. You've been listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson over in Berlin. Join us for the rest of the week as well. And don't forget, Autumn Statement, Thursday. That's the big day. Taxes are coming for the UK. This is Bloomberg.